Test 1. Task 1. Read carefully through the instructions and questions for Task 1.1. You have 3 minutes for this before the recording begins.
Billy Graham died recently. No matter what you thought of this high-profile American evangelist, there was no doubting his success in converting large numbers of people to his beliefs. It set me wondering why evangelists for science have not had similar success. Science has certainly had its evangelists, and back in the 19th century they often drew large crowds. One of the most successful was Giovanni Aldini, the nephew of the Italian scientist Luigi Galvani. Galvani discovered that animals could generate their own electricity, and also showed that an externally applied electric current could make a dead frog's legs kick. Aldini upped the ante by demonstrating the effects of electricity on the bodies of executed criminals in shows the length and breadth of Britain. One of his most spectacular efforts was in Glasgow, where he applied the electric current to an arm, which rose up, with the index finger straightening out and pointing at the audience. The startled Glaswegians scattered wildly, convinced that their sins had found them out. I was sure that my sins had found me out too when Billy Graham preached at the Sydney Showground in 1959 and pointed directly at me as a young teenager in the crowd. At least it seemed to me that he was pointing at me, and I rapidly decided to become a better person. Sadly for my mother, who was a devout Methodist, the effect soon wore off. But Billy made many more permanent converts, and that brings me back to my initial question. Why is it so difficult to convince people about the beauty and value of science? I was convinced at a young age, and I have never ceased to marvel at the wonderful range and depth of insights that science offers into the world around us. The fact that you are listening to The Science Show probably means that you are also fascinated by science and what it has to tell us about the world. Sadly, we are in a minority. For many people, science seems to represent something rather frightening, perhaps because it appears incomprehensible, or maybe because scientists are seen as wielding a frightening power, even the power of life and death. Billy Graham was also concerned with fear, the fear of eternal damnation. He implanted this fear into many minds on that day in the Sydney showground. But he made the fear work for him by offering an alternative, the certainty of eternal salvation for true believers. Scientists in recent times have also been concerned with fear. Fear of global warming. Fear of artificial intelligence. Fear of more destructive weapons. But unlike the Billy Grahams of this world, the answers that we offer do not have the reassurance of certainty. That can even lead to the greatest fear of all. The fear that we have opened Pandora's box and released to humanity knowledge that humanity was never meant to have. Science is like mountain climbing. We struggle to reach a peak, only to find that when we reach it, there is another peak hidden behind it, higher and more difficult to climb. Our questions lead to answers, but unlike the answers of religion, our answers lead to further questions. The scientific evangelists of earlier times emphasized the positive aspects of this process. They argue that our true salvation lies not in blindly accepting dogma, but in pursuing understanding and learning how to use that understanding for our benefit. Many religious evangelists of the time accepted the message. Instead of seeing science as the enemy, they gleefully joined forces, so that many popular science books of the time were published under the imprint of the Society for the Promotion of Christian Knowledge. One of the greatest promoters of science was Michael Faraday, whose many discoveries about electricity ushered in our modern electrical era. Victorian society flocked to his lectures at the Royal Institution on subjects as mundane as the chemical history of a candle. They were eager to find out how science was going to lead them to a better world. Those lectures at the Royal Institution continue to this day, mostly to audiences of schoolchildren. I've given a couple myself. Standing just where Faraday stood behind the great demonstration desk that he was the first to use. One of my talks was on the science of toffee apples, a subject even more mundane than the chemical history of a candle. But the intention was the same, to excite inquiring minds into wanting to catch on to science and what it can tell us about the world. The same goes for many of the science programs that now appear on television. But excitement is obviously not enough to overcome the fear of science that now permeates great sections of our community. It's not entirely the scientist's fault. The media thrive on drama, and there is more drama to be had from fear than there is from optimism or rational discussion. But there is another drama in science, the drama of climbing the mountain, and of finding answers that lead to further questions and higher peaks deep within the mountain range. We cannot compete with religious evangelists who offer untestable assurance of certainty. What we can offer, and should offer, is more along the lines of the non-evangelical religion of Buddhism, to share the path that we are following and to school others in its value. That value comprises a balanced mixture of excitement and reality. Scientific tele-evangelists of the modern era tend to focus on the former and to emphasize the fun of science. Not fun as generally understood in a playground or video game sort of way, but the fun of catching on. Alongside this, though, we also need to focus on the realities of science. Some of those realities can be bleak, such as the predictions of climate models. Others can be exhilarating, such as the discovery of gravitational waves, whose existence had been predicted by Einstein a century earlier. But in all cases, the answers are just a step along the path, leading to fresh questions and fresh hope. Science does provide answers, but we proselytizers for science are making a grave mistake if these are all that we have to offer, especially if we offer them in an atmosphere of fear. It is time for us to offer them in an atmosphere of hope. This means sharing not just the answers that we have to date, but the new questions that go with those answers. It is these questions and their pursuit that offer hope, even in an atmosphere of fear. Billy Graham died recently. No matter what you thought of this high-profile American evangelist, there was no doubting his success in converting large numbers of people to his beliefs. It set me wondering why evangelists for science have not had similar success. Science has certainly had its evangelists, and back in the 19th century they often drew large crowds. One of the most successful was Giovanni Aldini, the nephew of the Italian scientist Luigi Galvani. Galvani discovered that animals could generate their own electricity, and also showed that an externally applied electric current could make a dead frog's legs kick. Aldini upped the ante by demonstrating the effects of electricity on the bodies of executed criminals in shows the length and breadth of Britain. One of his most spectacular efforts was in Glasgow, where he applied the electric current to an arm, which rose up, with the index finger straightening out and pointing at the audience. The startled Glaswegians scattered wildly, convinced that their sins had found them out. I was sure that my sins had found me out too when Billy Graham preached at the Sydney Showground in 1959 and pointed directly at me as a young teenager in the crowd. At least, it seemed to me that he was pointing at me, and I rapidly decided to become a better person. Sadly for my mother, who was a devout Methodist, the effect soon wore off. But Billy made many more permanent converts, and that brings me back to my initial question. Why is it so difficult to convince people about the beauty and value of science? I was convinced at a young age, and I have never ceased to marvel at the wonderful range and depth of insights that science offers into the world around us. The fact that you are listening to The Science Show probably means that you are also fascinated by science and what it has to tell us about the world. Sadly, we are in a minority. For many people, science seems to represent something rather frightening, perhaps because it appears incomprehensible, or maybe because scientists are seen as wielding a frightening power, even the power of life and death. Billy Graham was also concerned with fear, the fear of eternal damnation. He implanted this fear into many minds on that day in the Sydney Showground. But he made the fear work for him by offering an alternative, the certainty of eternal salvation for true believers. Scientists in recent times have also been concerned with fear. Fear of global warming. Fear of artificial intelligence. Fear of more destructive weapons. But unlike the Billy Grahams of this world, the answers that we offer do not have the reassurance of certainty. That can even lead to the greatest fear of all. The fear that we have opened Pandora's box and released to humanity knowledge that humanity was never meant to have. Science is like mountain climbing. We struggle to reach a peak, only to find that when we reach it, there is another peak hidden behind it, higher and more difficult to climb. Our questions lead to answers, but unlike the answers of religion, our answers lead to further questions. The scientific evangelists of earlier times emphasized the positive aspects of this process. They argue that our true salvation lies not in blindly accepting dogma, but in pursuing understanding and learning how to use that understanding for our benefit. Many religious evangelists of the time accepted the message. Instead of seeing science as the enemy, they gleefully joined forces, so that many popular science books of the time were published under the imprint of the Society for the Promotion of Christian Knowledge. One of the greatest promoters of science was Michael Faraday, whose many discoveries about electricity ushered in our modern electrical era. Victorian society flocked to his lectures at the Royal Institution on subjects as mundane as the chemical history of a candle. They were eager to find out how science was going to lead them to a better world. Those lectures at the Royal Institution continue to this day, mostly to audiences of schoolchildren. I've given a couple myself. Standing just where Faraday stood behind the great demonstration desk that he was the first to use. One of my talks was on the science of toffee apples, a subject even more mundane than the chemical history of a candle. But the intention was the same, to excite inquiring minds into wanting to catch on to science and what it can tell us about the world. The same goes for many of the science programs that now appear on television. But excitement is obviously not enough to overcome the fear of science that now permeates great sections of our community. It's not entirely the scientist's fault. The media thrive on drama, and there is more drama to be had from fear than there is from optimism or rational discussion. But there is another drama in science, the drama of climbing the mountain, and of finding answers that lead to further questions and higher peaks deep within the mountain range. We cannot compete with religious evangelists who offer untestable assurance of certainty. What we can offer, and should offer, is more along the lines of the non-evangelical religion of Buddhism, to share the path that we are following and to school others in its value. That value comprises a balanced mixture of excitement and reality. Scientific tele-evangelists of the modern era tend to focus on the former and to emphasize the fun of science. Not fun as generally understood in a playground or video game sort of way, but the fun of catching on. Alongside this, though, we also need to focus on the realities of science. Some of those realities can be bleak, such as the predictions of climate models. Others can be exhilarating, such as the discovery of gravitational waves, whose existence had been predicted by Einstein a century earlier. But in all cases, the answers are just a step along the path, leading to fresh questions and fresh hope. Science does provide answers, but we proselytizers for science are making a grave mistake if these are all that we have to offer, especially if we offer them in an atmosphere of fear. It is time for us to offer them in an atmosphere of hope. This means sharing not just the answers that we have to date, but the new questions that go with those answers. It is these questions and their pursuit that offer hope, even in an atmosphere of fear.
Now answer the questions. You have 2 minutes to complete this task. Test 1. Task 2. Read carefully through the instructions and questions for Task 1.2. You have 2 minutes for this before the recording begins.
So before we start, I'm a bit nosy, so I wanted to know about the panel's own way of using social media and what they've learnt from it. I mean, Jamie, do you confine your use of social media to your research or, so to speak, to your virtual office life, or are you a bit of a hopeless addict scrolling through it from the moment you wake up?
Well, one of the great problems, actually, is it's blurred my personal and professional lives. I find it increasingly difficult to separate the two, so I feel like I'm somehow always at work, because first thing in the morning, I'm checking everything. I'm one of these people who keeps telling myself it's very important to maintain some offline time and you should dedicate some effort to doing that, and then find myself in the morning scrolling like an addict through all of my social feeds.
And how typical are you? Because we often conflate ourselves with broader demographics, and I know that your department at Demos, you're dedicated to researching impact of social media. I mean, is our perception right that we're spending more and more time on it?
Yes, it's absolutely right. It does, of course, vary person to person, and it varies by age, demographics, and other variables too, of course. But on average, I think we all spend roughly 2 hours a day on social media. And if you go back 4 or 5 years, it was maybe 20 or 30 minutes. And the other thing is it's a much bigger variety of platforms that we have on offer now. And that's getting blurred too, because increasingly you can watch television on social media. Mm-hmm. So it's no longer very easy to even say what social media is and what it is not.
Julia, you're an enthusiastic networker, and I assume that social media is a big part of that. How do you harness the tech to sort of maximise benefit without becoming the slave to the screen?
Well, academics talk about consumption rituals. I think it's important to have boundaries and barriers. I think we all run into trouble when we just let the tap run. The average active Facebook user, and there are now 2 billion of us, spend 50 minutes a day. So that's before all the other minutes that are being spent on Jamie's social media, if you like. So one has to have boundaries. I think being participatory and using social media to communicate is one aspect. I use it to both collate and curate information. I find out a lot from social media. I think it's the greatest value in a way. I'm less happy about the narcissistic aspects, which I'm sure we'll come on to. But I learn a lot and hopefully share a lot that I've learned on social media.
Babe, I'm going to pigeonhole you a bit as one of the kind of millennial, or sort of now that millennial generation can mean anything, I think, for about 15 years. So you're probably at the younger end of that. You probably don't even remember days before social media. So give me a sense of how you feel that you and your generation use it differently. I would guess that those of us on the panel who are, I mean, I know it's going to come as a surprise to the audience, but perhaps I'm not 28. We would know Twitter, I'm in an in-and-out relationship with Facebook, but do you think that is changing and expanding if we go down the age scale?
Yeah, I think so. Back in 2007 or in 2006, even when first Facebook came, I signed up. I was a dedicated user for years. And now, I think about 3 years ago, I have deactivated my Facebook account and I have moved on to Twitter and Instagram. And I think it's fair to say for a lot of my generation, and certainly for a lot of people in my circle, they spend much more time on Instagram or Pinterest or Snapchat.
And they are more picture. I mean, they can be used in different ways, but they're slightly more picture and image-led. Do you think that is, I mean, anyone else wants to jump in on this? Is social media now becoming more about the image than the word?
Yeah, oh, definitely. I think, and what really interests me is the fact that we're all of us now, or whoever carries a smartphone, are in a sense sort of mobile camera people. This is one of the most astonishing new suite of talents that we have in our digital toolbox. I think that this fact that we have a mobile crew of all the equipment we need to capture video on the hoof, as it were, I mean, that is a radical change that obviously is a force for good or bad, but it really changes our relationship to what has happened and what hasn't happened. If a moment can't be recorded, will we be more suspicious of it? There's an amazing, actually, on this point, an amazing product you could get for dog walkers, and it said, with our GPS maps and cameras, our trusted dog walkers will not just tell you they've walked the dog, they'll show you. So I wondered what's happening to the poor dog walkers who don't have the footage of this when the owner comes back. Will they be seen as these really, you know, seedy and reputable people because of it?
And you could, of course, just stick a chip in the dog collar, right? So you could monitor the dog on its own social feed. It really cannot be long. And just, Lauren, staying with you for a moment and your actual research. I mean, you look at emotional responses to the medium. And where has that sort of taken you in terms of having a philosophical take on social media and our relationship with it?
Yeah, what strikes me most about social media is that it seems to have betrayed, in a certain sense, the original utopian dreams of the 1990s form of the internet. You know, there's a famous declaration by John Perry Barlow, who talked about it being the internet, or cyberspace, as he would refer to it, being a place where there were no bodies. It was a place where you couldn't be governed by old practices. But it was really a space where identities were up for grabs, experimental, sort of quicksilver. You could be multiple people on these platforms. But social media, the way it's currently been designed and from the get-go, has been to solidify and remind us of our identities all the time. We're linked to who, you know, you're embedded in with your friendship group, where you went to university, where do you work. It even now acts as your own memory system, saying, remember when this happened in your life? So it's always solidifying who we are as people. That sort of quicksilver self has no real place in the current social media model.
And Julia, how does that apply if you, I mean, you work a lot also with businesses, and you talk about kind of a social health as a way that we would talk about other social capital. Can we actually assess our own social health very well? Or is it something that really we stand back and we sort of look at the whole society? People say, I'm very worried about the amount of time people spend on social media, and then we'll immediately dive back into it themselves. We have a disassociation when it comes to us.
I think there is a huge disassociation, and ironically, it coincides with the so-called death of distance. It's really an incredibly short period of time since computerized, hyper-connected devices have moved from being somewhere over there, you know, in a locked room in a server, to actually on the end of our desk and now in our hands, you know, on a piece of kit no bigger than, you know, a square of supermarket cheese. And this has really brought with it the promise of intimacy, but of course it's a screen that distances us one from the other. My introducing the idea of social health is that I don't think we have anything like the literacy around how we connect as we do, for example, about how we consume food or how fit we are. Pretty much everybody listening to this program and in this room at the moment has probably counted a calorie or a carb, or has bought a pair of trainers, or knows that, you know, to be hydrated is better than to be dehydrated. But those questions about consumption and behavior around connectedness online, offline, what we know, what sources of information, none of that is sort of in the narrative, and that's what I believe needs to change. And I think it is changing. I think this sort of discussion is in fact part of social health.
So before we start, I'm a bit nosy, so I wanted to know about the panel's own way of using social media and what they've learnt from it. I mean, Jamie, do you confine your use of social media to your research, or so to speak, to your virtual office life, or are you a bit of a hopeless addict scrolling through it from the moment you wake up?
Well, one of the great problems, actually, is it's blurred my personal and professional lives. That I find it increasingly difficult to separate the two, so I feel like I'm somehow always at work, because first thing in the morning, I'm checking everything. I'm one of these people who keeps telling myself it's very important to maintain some offline time and you should dedicate some effort to doing that, and then find myself in the morning scrolling like an addict through all of my social feeds.
And how typical are you? Because we often conflate ourselves with broader demographics, and I know that your department at Demos, you're dedicated to researching impact of social media. I mean, is our perception right that we're spending more and more time on it?
Yes, it's absolutely right. It does, of course, vary person to person, and it varies by age, demographics, and other variables too, of course. But on average, I think we all spend roughly 2 hours a day on social media. And if you go back 4 or 5 years, it was maybe 20 or 30 minutes. And it's The other thing is it's a much bigger variety of platforms that we have on offer now, and it's that's getting blurred too, because increasingly you can watch television on social media, mm-hmm. and you can, so it's no longer very easy to even say what social media is and what it is not.
Julia, you're an enthusiastic networker, and I assume that social media is a big part of that. How do you harness the tech to sort of maximise benefit without becoming the slave to the screen?
Well, academics talk about consumption rituals. I think it's important to have boundaries and barriers. I think we all run into trouble when we just let the tap run. The average active Facebook user, and there are now 2 billion of them, of us, spend 50 minutes a day. So that's before all the other minutes that are being spent on Jamie's social media, if you like. So one has to have boundaries. I think being participatory and using social media to communicate is one aspect. I use it to both collate and curate information. I find out a lot from social media. I think it's the greatest value in a way. I'm less happy about the narcissistic aspects, which I'm sure we'll come on to. But I learn a lot and hopefully share a lot that I've learned on social media.
Babe, I'm going to pigeonhole you a bit as one of the kind of millennial, or sort of now that millennial generation can mean anything, I think, you know, about 15 years. So you're probably at the younger end of that. You probably don't even remember days before social media. So give me a sense of how you feel that you and your generation use it differently. I would guess that those of us on the panel who are, I mean, I know it's going to come as a surprise to the audience, but perhaps I'm not 28. We would know Twitter. We have an in-and-out relationship with Facebook, but do you think that that is changing and expanding if we go down the age scale?
Yeah, I think so. Back in 2007 or 2006, even when first Facebook came, I signed up. I was a dedicated user for years. And now, I think about 3 years ago, I have deactivated my Facebook account and I have moved on to Twitter and Instagram. And I think it's fair to say for a lot of my generation, and certainly for a lot of people in my circle, they spend much more time on Instagram or Pinterest or Snapchat.
And they are more picture, I mean, they can be used in different ways, but they're slightly more picture and image-led. Do you think that is, I mean, anyone else wants to jump in on this? Is social media now becoming more about the image than the word?
Yeah, oh, definitely. I think, and what really interests me is the fact that we're all of us now, or whoever carries a smartphone, are in a sense sort of mobile camera people. This is one of the most astonishing new suite of talents that we have in our digital toolbox. I think that this fact that we have a mobile crew of all the equipment we need to capture video on the hoof, as it were, I mean, that is a radical change that obviously is a force for good or bad, but it really changes our relationship to what has happened and what hasn't happened. If a moment can't be recorded, will we be more suspicious of it? There's an amazing, actually on this point, an amazing product you could get for dog walkers, and it said, with our GPS maps and cameras, our trusted dog walkers will not just tell you they've walked the dog, they'll show you. So I wondered what's happening to the poor dog walkers who don't have the footage of this when the owner comes back. Will they be seen as these really, you know, seedy and reputable people because of it?
And you could, of course, just stick a chip in the dog collar, right? So you could monitor the dog on on its own social feed. It really cannot be long. And just, Lauren, staying with you for a moment and your actual research. I mean, you look at emotional responses to the medium. And where has that sort of taken you in terms of having a philosophical take on social media and our relationship with it?
Yeah, what strikes me most about social media is that it seems to have betrayed, in a certain sense, the original utopian dreams of the 1990s form of the internet. You know, there's a famous declaration by John Perry Barlow, who talked about it being the internet, or cyberspace as he would refer to it, being a place where there were no bodies. It was a place where you couldn't be governed by old practices. But it was really a space where identities were up for grabs, experimental, sort of quicksilver. You could be multiple people on these platforms. But social media, the way it's currently been designed and from the get-go, has been to solidify and remind us of our identities all the time. We're linked to who, you know, you're embedded in with your friendship group, where you went to university, where do you work. It even now acts as your own memory system, saying, remember when this happened in your life? So it's always solidifying who we are as people. That sort of quicksilver self has no real place in the current social media model.
And Julia, how does that apply if you, I mean, you work a lot also with businesses, and you talk about kind of a social health. Is there a way that we would talk about other social capital? Can we actually assess our own social health very well? Or is it something that really we stand back and we sort of look at the whole society? People say, I'm very worried about the amount of time people spend on social media, and then we'll immediately dive back into it themselves. We have a disassociation when it comes to us.
I think there is a huge disassociation, and ironically, it coincides with the so-called death of distance. It's really an incredibly short period of time since computerized, hyper-connected devices have moved from being somewhere over there, you know, in a locked room in a server, to actually on the end of our desk and now in our hands, you know, on a piece of kit no bigger than, you know, a square of supermarket cheese. And this has really brought with it the promise of intimacy, but of course it's a screen that distances us one from the other. My introducing the idea of social health is that I don't think we have anything like the literacy around how we connect as we do, for example, about how we consume food or how fit we are. Pretty much everybody listening to this program and in this room at the moment has probably counted a calorie or a carb or has bought a pair of trainers or knows that, you know, to be hydrated is better than to be dehydrated. But those questions about consumption and behavior around connectedness online, offline, what we know, what sources of information, none of that is sort of in the narrative, and that's what I believe needs to change. And I think it is changing. I think this sort of discussion is in fact part of social health.
Now answer the questions. You have 2 minutes to complete this task. You should now move on to complete the remaining parts of the test.